Motion, perhaps, of the day. So some of us have come having thought over these questions already. But if you haven't, that's fine too. Please participate anyway. Let's begin with prayer. Lord Jesus, we thank you for the gift of your word. We thank you especially today for the book of Daniel. What a unique book in your Old Testament scriptures. Show us what a powerful God you are. What a saving God you are. And help us to trust with the same kind of faith as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, I'll start by reading through the section for the first day. On Monday, you were asked to read Daniel 3, verses 1 through 7. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold 90 feet high and 9 feet wide and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. He then summoned the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. So the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials assembled for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before it. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "This is what you are commanded to do, O peoples, nations, and men of every language. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace." Therefore, as soon as they heard the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, and all kinds of music, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down and worshipped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Our first question in connection with that section is, what may have given Nebuchadnezzar the idea of making an image of gold? Keep in mind the previous chapter. Sherry? Yes. Remember, the previous time we had seen how Nebuchadnezzar had a dream in which he saw a statue and the head of the statue was gold. And of course, when Daniel interpreted the dream, who did he interpret the head of gold as representing? Nebuchadnezzar, or Babylon, right? So, could it be an example of it goes to your head, right? And so he makes this statue. It's the dimensions of it seem very unusual for a statue. I read several commentators during the week, and they wondered if it could be more of an obelisk. Sometimes these poles and things that would be set up were not so much natural representations of a bodily form, but rather kind of a stylized symbol of someone. Now, one thing it does not say, however, about the statue, and what is that? I mean, I think we might assume it, but it doesn't say what, Brian?
That it was necessarily a man or animal or what it was.
Yes, it doesn't say that what shape it is in. And we might assume, too, if this is going to Nebuchadnezzar's head, who might it be a representation of Nebuchadnezzar, right? Notice it doesn't say that explicitly. However, it had to be some type of god or something, because in 7, it says the people fell down and worshipped the image of gold, right? So it was clearly not just like the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C., as a rallying point or a symbol of power or something like that. It obviously had religious significance, right? Anything else as to why King Nebuchadnezzar may have made it?
It's funny he didn't remember all the other elements of that dream. He only remembered the one, and it's how pride can take over.
Yeah.
So into yourself, don't even think about it.
Because what happened in the dream to the statue? Collapsed, right? So is Nebuchadnezzar so short-sighted that he's only seeing his moment in history And is he not concerned about the time of collapse that is coming? That he sets up, you know, the taller they are, the harder they fall, right? We're going to see this character trait in Nebuchadnezzar, especially next week in chapter 4. He does seem to be very self-focused. Okay, any other things about the statue and why Nebuchadnezzar may have made it? Then reflect on Nebuchadnezzar's comment to Daniel in the previous chapter and consider what his ideas may have been about Daniel's God and his gods. Let's take a look at that. That was after Daniel interpreted his dream in verse 47. The king said to Daniel, "Surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you were able to reveal this mystery." What do you think Nebuchadnezzar's religious beliefs were at this time? Mark.
He made a lot of different gods, so he just kind of said, well, in the ranking, you're God, the best out of all the gods, so we're going to give you the top ranking.
Your God is the God of gods, right? Notice there's no repudiation of the other gods by any means. But he's putting the God of Daniel ahead of the others, right? So this seems to be the mindset of Nebuchadnezzar at this point in his life. As you've noticed already through the weeks, we're constantly monitoring his religious progress. Next week is going to be the end of what we see about Nebuchadnezzar. So keep in mind to observe the progress that he seems to be making, or perhaps lack of progress. Anything else on 247? Okay, then number 3. What about Nebuchadnezzar's dedication day plans make it obvious that he considered this and this event very important? Jim. All the important people of the kingdom, right? Is there, how would you characterize that long list of all these people? Joyce. Yes. Everybody who was anybody, right, is the impression that it gives. Anything else? Kelly. Yes, all the political leaders, right? Anybody who has any political power is invited to this event. Dan.
Finding that this book is remarkable both in what it says and also what it doesn't say. And he doesn't say that the astrologers and magicians are invited. Or any of the people from the previous chapter.
That's interesting, because we've had that list already, right?
Yeah.
It specifically does not say that the astrologers, the dream interpreters, the magicians are invited. But it lists this long list of officials, and this comes up several times, right? Have you noticed the repetition, especially in this chapter? Now, what would the purpose of repetition be? Probably a little difficult for us to recreate it, because we live in modern times, whereas ways of speaking or customs in ancient times aren't always real apparent to us. Joyce, what do you think? Okay. Since many stories were told orally rather than written down back in ancient times, perhaps this is kind of like a little, you can flesh out your story and say a lot of words without having to think up stuff, right? Perhaps that's why lists like this get in our customary ways of telling a dramatic story. Any other thoughts that occur to you? Rosemary. Perhaps because the king has written it out on his decree that whenever it's announced, all of them have to be announced. The satraps, prefects, governors, you know, official language is always full of, it's very verbose, right? I wonder too, during this week, if this could be an example of the pompousness of the kingdom of Babylon. That this is a typical way. Remember, this section is in Aramaic, which is the international language. This is their way of showing greatness. Look at all the people in my government. Okay? So he goes on with a long list. Today it would be something like the governors and the members of Congress and the mayors and the sheriffs and the county clerks and the, you know, getting paid down to everybody. Kelly.
What Rosemary said about it's like a command, it almost does seem like it because they all responded. Everybody came.
Yes. And everybody came, right? It was the kind of command that you didn't say no to when the king commanded it, right? Okay, let's go on to the next one. What political purpose is hinted at in verse 4 as to why Nebuchadnezzar set up the image? Look at the wording of verse 4 once. Can you see what Nebuchadnezzar is trying to do here by setting up one god?
I thought maybe there was unity. Trying to bring all these people together, all these different nations that he had put together, and he's trying to bring them all under his command because he's the head and he's the gold head, and then he's got all these people underneath him. And by bringing in these political people, he's making a statement that even though you guys are political, I'm still the head, I'm still in charge.
Okay. Yes. It was a unifying effect that he was working for, right? He brings these people, these provincial governors from all the provinces of the empire together and tries to unify them in what area of life? Religion, right? Are you aware how important that is to leaders still today that a nation have unity of religion? It's one of the things that American politicians really struggle with. Trying to appease the different religious groups within America and trying to get them on the same page. There have been times in recent history that you may not be aware of where kings back in Europe specifically worked on this in order to shore up their political power, where they would strive to bring all of the Protestant groups, for instance, into one church. You're aware, some of you who have attended my History of Lutheranism course, that that's why the conservative Lutherans came to America, because the kings of northern Germany were trying to all put them together into one generic Protestant church, because that would shore up their power. Sometimes they would try to force the Catholics out of their lands, or if it was a Catholic country, then get rid of the Protestants. But we got to get this religious power base. And in a much more subtle form, it happens still today, doesn't it? In America, even though we're such a diverse nation when it comes to religion. Many of the attempts to try to bring everybody onto the same page religiously is some leader's attempt to get power. Quick. Was one leader, and he wanted everybody to look to one people, to one leader, and that they all be one people. Gwen points out a good thing, and all the different languages, there must have been translating going on during this ceremony, or what have you already learned about language in the book of Daniel? What unifying force was there, even among the various languages? They all understood Aramaic, or a great part of the population understood Aramaic. This must have been another program that the kings had fostered in order to get a unity among the empire. And it probably started already in the previous one with the Assyrians, where this Aramaic was fostered among everybody. So it was clearly a unifying effort that the king was making. Okay, we're a little past halfway down the page. Why do you think Nebuchadnezzar would have used a punishment like death in a furnace for disobedience to his order? Brian.
I think perhaps he knew he didn't have the unity that he was looking for with all these diverse peoples.
And so the fire was really what?
Motivation.
And what kind of motivation? Fear, right? We've talked before about how Nebuchadnezzar used fear. Does anybody remember from the previous chapters? Remember, can you give us an example of how he used fear to govern? Remember, I'll hack you into pieces and I'll turn your houses into piles of rubble if you do not tell me what my dream was. Man, what a demanding guy and what a fear-motivating person. Now, I want you to keep this in mind because as we're tracking Nebuchadnezzar's progress, I want you to ask yourself the question, does he ever vary from this fear motivation that he tries to use as his governing style? Did anybody come up with any other reasons for the fiery furnace, Martha?
Well, it just almost seems like there's an edge of desperation. It's just like, I gotta do something, you know?
Okay.
I don't know if he's mean and nasty, but it's like, look at all the stuff that's already happened, I'm desperate, I gotta do something here.
Okay. He is mean and nasty, Martha says, but is there even a tone of desperation in Nebuchadnezzar's mind? I would say, it's intriguing that Martha brings that up, but I would say I don't think he should have had to worry about that, right? Because in verse 7, what does everybody do? They all get down, except three guys are standing up there in the middle of the prostrate group, right? But maybe there is some desperation. With a dream, I can see it probably more than with this here. But who knows what it's like when you're on top of an empire like that if you're not fearful every moment of people who might bring you down. Paul?
During that period of time, there was a big crime called double crime, where you death by fire if you committed the double crime. That means a crime against the king and the body. Death by fire.
And you found that as you were studying this week? Huh. Oh, I didn't come across that.
That was a villain of the land, of the kings. If you did anything against a king and God, that was a double crime, that was death by fire.
Okay. Paul did some study this week and came across a concept among the Babylonians called the double crime, where if your crime was against the king and against the god, the punishment was fire. So it was a customary punishment, evidently.
I found that they had, in Leviticus, the law had commanded death by fire for several different accounts. And then also, Nebuchadnezzar had used it in Jeremiah before to kill people. And that was a form of capital punishment, so to speak.
That's right. Trish points out how even in the law of God, in Leviticus, there were certain crimes that were punishable by fire. And did you happen to write down the ones from Jeremiah?
Yeah, 29:21-22.
Okay. Jeremiah 29:21-22 says that Nebuchadnezzar used fire as, had killed some people using fire.
And even already in Genesis, Tamar was going to be burnt to death for her sin against Judah, because when they thought she was the prostitute, and she was, you know, then she was found pregnant, and they, you know, so, by her father-in-law. So she was actually on her way to be burnt when she sent the thing to Judah. So even in Genesis.
The punishment for Tamar, I don't know if you remember that one back in the days of the patriarchs. She was about to be burned as a punishment for incest with her father-in-law. But then there were extenuating circumstances with that. Anybody else find anything on fire? Why the punishment of fire? Okay, then let's go on to the next question. Why would all the people have obeyed Nebuchadnezzar's order so unquestioningly in verse 7? Well, we already gave one reason, right? Fear. Nebuchadnezzar's been an awful emperor. They've all been conquered by him. They've had their villages turned to rubble when his army came in. So fear would have caused it. Anybody come up with anything else?
I still don't
to why they all bow down. Doesn't it strike you as kind of odd? I mean, being a modern American, that everybody would bow down? That's such a foreign concept to us, right? Because we're such individualists. We could never get the entire population, or almost all the population, to agree to anything, could we? It's very foreign to us. Mark?
Plus, to me, that many of these people at the time also had a lot of other gods, too. So, like, here's another one, just bow down. Yeah. You know, it's just another one.
Yeah, this is another important point, right? These people were polytheists. That means they believed in many different gods. And depending on who was in power at the time, you would naturally, if you got conquered by that kingdom, you would assume, well, their god must be more powerful than our god, so we need to bow down to this god. They were used to doing it. So the reason I'm glad this point came out is because I want you to understand the uniqueness of the Jewish and the Christian religion in that it has a very exclusive idea about it. And this was something very new to the world. It really impressed itself on me the time we studied Isaiah. Isaiah really brings that to the fore. He not only says that God is the greatest of the gods, but he keeps saying in his book, God, the Lord is the only God. And all the peoples around him, the Ammonites, the Moabites, they each had their own God, and they were happy to say, well, but in your country, your God reigns. This was the novel idea that was being proclaimed to the world now in the days of the prophets, that the Lord, he is the God of the whole world. And see, this is the kind of difference in beliefs that contributes to three men staying standing on a day when everyone else was bowing down. This type of belief is what makes Christians be different from the world, right? The rest of the world is happy to say, well, let's just go along with it. If my product isn't selling so well, well, then I'll just go over to this product over here and start selling it, or this product over here, right? And it really doesn't matter the quality of the product or the benefit that it brings to people. As long as it's selling, we'll do whatever, right? Whatever to get by. The Christian faith is a much different faith, right, than all other religions that are out there. Michelle.
Two questions were bugging me as I was studying this. Number one, where was Daniel? And two, there had to have been other, you know, Israelites there. Why were they bowing down and just raising hands, right in the face of them?
Good questions to bring to your mind. I don't know if there's any answers for them, though. In the commentaries I read, everybody's wondering, where is Daniel? There must have been something going on. He's a very important official. I don't know, was he an ambassador or something in a different country at the time or what? But it's clear that he's kept out of the story. So something must have happened. But there is no clue anywhere in the book or anywhere else as to why Daniel is not in this account. But your other question is intriguing. Were there other Jews there who were bowing down on that day? I doubt whether the three men were the old Jews there. Go ahead. Remember last time, even though Nebuchadnezzar had changed their names way in the beginning, last time they were still using their Jewish names among each other. Now in this chapter, it's always the Babylonian names, right? So here they're out in the world, I think, and they're being called by those Babylonian names. Yeah, good point. Okay, any other questions yet on Monday's assignment? Yes, Dave. Yeah, could Daniel perhaps have been purposely kept out of there because of his interpreting of the dream last time. And, was there some, maybe even the Babylonians themselves were in on it. Let's heal Daniel from this. We know how he's gonna react, and perhaps there were some people who were protecting him. Paul.
My interpretation would be that they were more afraid of Daniel than they were of these three because of what Daniel did. These three didn't interpret the dream, so they were more subject to, you know, sacrifice than Daniel.
This is a good point too. Notice in the next segment, the astrologers are going to turn in the three men in the fiery furnace, but they don't say anything about Daniel. Could Daniel have been there on that day standing, and it's simply that he wasn't turned in? It's another wrinkle that could possibly be in there. Okay, let's go on to Tuesday's assignment. What is ironic about the fact that some astrologers turn in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego for disobeying the king's command? Sue? Yes. Daniel and the three men had been instrumental in saving the astrologers and magicians and dream interpreters in the previous account, right? The king had said, off with their heads, and Daniel spoke up and said, no, give me a chance to interpret the dream. And now the very people who had been saved by these Jewish wise men are turning them in. Now, my next question is, apply it to our lives. What does this teach us about how a Christian deals with the opposing forces of the world? What can you learn from this irony? Paul. Serve the Lord and don't worry about the consequences, right? But let's... I want to explore a little bit more what the world does in these kind of situations.
Jesus says
we need to be more discerning. We need to scrutinize more.
Suzanne.
There you go, right?
He still will. I don't think it means don't save the astrologer.
The Christian still steps up and saves the astrologer and does not look for reward from that astrologer that he is going to be cooperative with me and he's going to save me when it's my hide. See, the Christian can expect this kind of lack of cooperation from the world, right? We are kind to the world not because they're kind to us in return, but why are we kind to them? Because Jesus has been kind to us, right? That is one of the most important lessons for Christians to learn about the Christian way of life, right? The world is always going to be unfair to us. That's their way of operating. That's how they get ahead, right? And we can learn a peace and a contentment with that. Because we have already been saved from the fiery furnace, haven't we? By our Savior Jesus. And so, if somebody turns us into the punishment of fire, well, I like how they're going to word it in a couple of verses from now. They're just unafraid if God allows them to be thrown into the fiery furnace. Linda.
That brings up a question in my mind.
Yes,
in the stewardship that they're talking about, how do you deal with the fiery furnace? Because it seems like that manager was commended for being shrewd in dealing with people. And isn't there a proverb that says, be wise as snakes, but innocent as doves?
Yes.
And so it's like, you accept things, but yet you're not supposed to be passive. And how do you find that balance?
Yeah. That's a tricky one, isn't it?
Because it was almost shrewd of them to accept their names from Nebuchadnezzar, mm-hmm. but yet innocent not to bow down. I mean, and I know you can't really answer how to find the balance.
Because everyone's situation is different, right? And each of us are going to have to determine, now when should I be shrewd and try to escape the consequences that the world is foisting on me? And when should I simply let myself be placed into their hands for them to abuse me, right? I don't think any of us should seek to be abused by the world. I think there have been Christians who have been so overboard in their emotional view of I have to suffer for the Lord that they almost make themselves into targets for it, right? That's one of the things I think we should keep in mind. Don't make yourself a target for the world's abuse. But if you go down a certain path and realize, oh my goodness, they are looking at me, just have the kind of grace under pressure that Daniel showed last time, where, remember, he was not at all flappable at the time when he was supposed to be put to death because no one could interpret the dream. He spoke to the guard who came to him with wisdom and tact, it says. And then he boldly went into the king's throne room and said, O king, give me an opportunity to explain your dream to you. I think those are probably two of the key points. Don't make yourself a target. And when you find yourself in that kind of position, don't get shaken up by it. Paul.
I learned a long time ago two words. A Christian doesn't ask why. A Christian asks why. What does God want? Why did God do this? You ask, what does God want? If you concentrate on God, then you're not thinking about anything else. That's not the why question. The why question is putting yourself equal instead of under God alongside of him. We all want to be our own God alongside of him, rather than be under God and let him control us, rather than we be partaking in this path that we're taking. And when we get that attitude, then we're in trouble.
Good point. Paul says a good way to keep it in balance is to ask God the question, what, rather than why. We're all prone to ask the question, why, when we go through some kind of persecution. And what we're doing when we do that, Paul says, is we're setting ourselves alongside of God. We all would like to be a fellow God of God, right? Consider ourselves his equals and be able to ask him questions. Like, why are you letting this happen? When really the question we should be asking is, what is your will, God? And that automatically puts us below God rather than next to him. I'm intrigued by, can I go further into your point? I'm intrigued by Paul's answer because let me point ahead to your work for next time. Go to Daniel 4. Daniel 4:35. These are the last words we hear Nebuchadnezzar speak in the book of Daniel. I'm only going to take the last two lines of verse 35. No one can hold back his hand or say to him, what have you done? See, that it starts with what, but it really is a why question, isn't it? And Nebuchadnezzar, by the end, gets to the point where he realizes what Paul has just articulated. No one should be asking God why. Because as soon as you ask that question, you're putting yourself on a par with God, that he is answerable to you. And that's not his nature. He's not there as your servant, as the one who must give an answer to you for every action that he does. It's intriguing that Nebuchadnezzar learns that by the end. Brian.
And then asking why comes up all throughout the book of Job.
Yes.
All these guys are trying to figure out why, and God comes in at the end and says, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth, and who are you to darken my presence with your counsel?
Yes.
Something like that. Yeah.
Exactly. Big points in the book of Job.
I wonder, too, how much these three men who were Jewish had to suffer because being in waiting.
That's a good point. The three men were there as a result of a prophecy God gave that the people would be sent into the Babylonian captivity. And they were such trusting people, trusting in the Lord, that they were waiting there for the next revelation of God, the next prophecy of what was going to happen to them. So there obviously was a lot of trust in them. You got to keep that in mind. I think we need to move on so that we get everything covered. Good thoughts there. The bottom question says, what prevented the three men from worshiping the image of gold? And again, then, apply this to your life today. Name a god that you are tempted to worship just like everyone else. What was it that kept the three men standing on that day?
I think it's important to remember this because it was the god of their fathers. Mm-hmm. They were instructed properly, and they maintained that instruction properly.
Okay. This was the god of their fathers. They had been instructed about this god earlier. It had been handed down from generations. This was a religious belief that had been time-tested, right? And handed down the way God said. I saw another hand here. Joyce, what did you put down? They feared God more than they feared Nebuchadnezzar. That's another good way of saying it. Martha, did you have a hand up?
Oh, it's just faith. They were dedicated to serving God. They didn't have any interest.
Faith, dedicated to serving God. Louisa? The Holy Spirit, right, was the one that had given them the strength. Through all the Word of God that they had been nourished with as they were growing up, that gave them the strength. Anything else?
God is listening for Israel.
Yes, the first commandment, right? They had been raised learning these commandments by heart. You shall have no other gods, right? Anything else? Okay, then let's go. Now we got the application. Gods today, what god are you subtly asked to bow down to, and maybe every once in a while you shake yourself out of it and say, nope, I'm not going to bow down to that? Rich?
Money.
Money, right? Money is a powerful force in people's minds, and if trusted in too much, it becomes their god. And I think all of us have been tempted at one time or another to join in with the ranks of the world and say, oh, you are my god, money. What else? Louisa? Perhaps even something like the environment. Now, of course, as Christians, we know from the creation account that we were created in order to take care of the environment. And so it is a good thing. We should be very concerned about taking care of the environment. But I rode my bike into the gym a couple weeks ago, and the guy at the desk complimented me for it and said I was doing a good thing for Mother Earth. And the way he was speaking of it made me think he views the earth as something more than just this wonderful resource that the Lord has created for us. Okay? Linda.
My temptation might be when I hate conflict, worship the God, let's just
all get along. Maybe that's a God, huh? Let's just all get along. And if we're compliant type of people, just get along people, we'll line up with the rest of them that want to bow down to that God. Right? Sherry. Any of the self-gods, right? They go by many different names, whether it's self-worth or egotism, whatever it is. It really comes down to my desire, what I want for life, self-fulfillment, right? Well, be careful, because you might be setting up a 90-foot statue of yourself by doing it. Pam. There's another one. I don't know if it's ever occurred to you, but this particular idea in America has been put in the shape of goddesses many times. The Statue of Liberty, right? A Greek goddess there, right? Carrying the torch with the crown around her head. Or on the top of the Capitol building in the United States is another one that's called the Statue of Freedom, I believe. Again, in the form of a god or goddess. And we, you know, we look at those things and we're not even thinking religiously, but do we sometimes bow down to those concepts in a country like America? Yeah. Could be. We could make it into play, into a god, right? Who is it? Government can be a god, right? When people look to it as solving all of their problems and taking care of them, as long as I kowtow to it, as long as I bow down to it. One of the commentaries that I'm reading is the Tyndale commentary, which is very much focused on getting the word of God out in the English language throughout the world. And it often uses good examples from out there in the world. Several, for this particular chapter, there were several examples given. I think one was Ghana, in the country of Ghana, where the president or leader of Ghana made a statue of himself and had the people of Ghana bow down to that statue. That he is the symbol of, you know, the all-powerful, the one who takes care of.
Okay, let's keep moving. On the top of the next page, we're now into Daniel 3, 13 through 18. So Daniel was... Oh, excuse me, I'm in the wrong chapter. Daniel's not in this one. Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold I have set up? Now when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what god will be able to rescue you from my hand?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it. And he will rescue us from your hand, O king. But even if he does not, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." First question in that section. Why do you think the whole list of instruments is repeated so often in the account? I mean, before we talked about the prestigiousness of the people and that sort of thing, but come on, isn't he going a little far with repeating all the instruments every time the music's brought up? What do you think, Brian?
Two reasons. First of all, there's a large variety of instruments, which tells me that the music had an international flavor to it. He's pulling, you know, all kinds of music. He's pulling all kinds of music from different parts of his kingdom. And second, I think there's a lot of order here, and this was a structured worship service with all the elements going into worship service. This just wasn't an impromptu thing. We're going to blow a horn, everyone bows down, you go home. I think this was a structured worship service.
Huh? Very interesting. Brian used to be chairman of the board of worship. He sees elements of worship in it.
I also found that the instruments signal military victory a lot of times in the Old Testament, and so I wondered if maybe by repeating those, showing his power.
Church and state, do you see it? Those were always merged in the ancient societies, right? So military victory, worship instruments from all over the world. Let me comment a little on Brian. Three of them are Greek words, which is very interesting to people and is part of the reason some people think it was Daniel, Book of Daniel, written later. They'll use that as an excuse. However, careful study of history shows that the Greeks were very influential in the Middle East when it came to instruments, and that they exported their instruments to places like Babylon, and it wouldn't have been unusual to have Greek instruments there. But again, Brian's point about bringing all of them to make the people bow down is again showing this diverseness that Nebuchadnezzar is trying to bring together from all the nations to bring them on the same page. Rosemary. Words are very important in that culture, no doubt. And again, going back to my point about the repetition, to show the prestigiousness of this, right? Nebuchadnezzar must be a quite pompous person who is really full of himself, right? Daniel, or Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, when you hear the flute, zither, lyre, you know, he's really waxing eloquent. He thinks, wow, what a great, listen to my symphony orchestra. And then bow down. What a grandiose moment, right? To bow down. Okay, we need to keep going. Second question. Consider the question at the end of verse 15. Why do you think Daniel quotes it in this account? Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? Ellie. Right? And you and I want to answer that question by saying, the Lord will do it, right? So Daniel, as he's recording this account, says, I can't let this out of the account. And on that day, Nebuchadnezzar even said, now what God will deliver you from my hand? Well, you can imagine a Jewish audience reading this. You know, this is foreshadowing of how the story is going to end, right? That's why it's put in there, for dramatic effect. I think this whole account is very dramatic in an Aramaic way. That's why all the repetitions. I mean, this is great. This is not just a great event in which God shows his power, but it's told well from the ancient perspective, right? Next question. Consider the wording of the three men's reply to the king. How do they very carefully word their witness to the king? What facts about their faith are they so meticulously and boldly proclaiming to this man who thinks he is the all-powerful ruler of the world? Very interesting wording. Mark?
There's one tiny word in here, I'm sure, that the king has never heard spoken before, and also boldness. I mean, nobody can say this.
Yeah.
No, King Nebuchadnezzar, if you do this, you know, he probably was furious from that point on. He probably said, if, what do you mean, if I can do this, I can do whatever I want.
Yeah.
And they told him that, and it's like, you know, God even lets you do this, you know, then okay. But, you know, he probably never heard that word in his life. Probably he was burning from the time he said.
If is making Nebuchadnezzar angry. Go ahead. Isn't this what trust in God is all about? I know that my God can rescue me from this fire. I know that he will not let me suffer this. But there's a thought in there, isn't it? He's wiser than I am. And simply because I believe that it's going to happen a certain way does not mean it's going to turn out that way. He may let me go into the fire. But let me tell you, Nebuchadnezzar, that if I am placed in that fire, my God will rescue me anyway. And I wonder how much even of the overtones of the fire of hell isn't in their wording, right? That I know my God will rescue me from the fire, right? He will not allow me to suffer that kind of fate. Susan.
Except that they say, even if he does not,
then it is true faith, isn't it? If I can say, yes, even though I go through this painful suffering, my God will be with me. Otherwise, anybody can say, well, I have faith that God would never let me suffer. That's a childish statement, right?
That's our society.
But that's how many Christians profess their faith, right? It's just a fond hope or a wish, you know, that God would rescue me from something like the fire. Okay. You think so? Yeah, depending on how the lion counts on you. I don't know if I'd rate them,
I think these three men, I can think of 6-7 different reasons that could have got out of this without anybody ever getting anything done.
Yeah.
They're new in the land.
Yeah.
Young. I mean, they got their whole life ahead. These are very young men. They made a very serious decision that they could have got out of.
Yes.
They could have just said, well, what the heck, one time a week, and we'll come.
Yes.
Same with today. We do the same thing today. We'll say, well, what's it hurt to go have a couple of drinks? You know, we compromise our faith sometimes instead of taking that bold stance.
Compromise is so easy. Excuse making is so easy. These men could have gotten out of this so easily by just saying a thing that Nebuchadnezzar would have complimented them for. But they stood by their conviction. There.
They chose to be addressed by these Babylonians with pagan names that honor their gods, and yet they still don't stand for this.
Yes.
It's just kind of confusing why they put their foot down at this point, rather than saying, you know what, from our perspective, we're not worshiping this image as our God, we're just lying down on the ground.
Yep. Choosing their battles, why did they choose this particular one? I don't know. Could they have been put to death for saying, we don't want those names that you're foisting on us? I think they had a good sense. They knew that this was the kind of dramatic event that needed to be, where the statement needed to be made to Nebuchadnezzar. Okay, good thoughts. We need to move on again. On what grounds could these men be so confident of what their God would do for them? Find grounds for such confidence in other parts of Scripture. Did you find any?
Jonah. Jonah swallowed by a whale. I'm dripped in. I should be dead. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other examples from Old Testament history?
The Exodus.
Because the Pharaoh was coming down on them. They were trapped against the Red Sea.
Yeah.
God parted the sea and they escaped. This is one that I came across. Isaiah 43:2-3. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And when you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. The flames will not set you ablaze. The Lord had promised this. He had shown his power in so many miracles in the Old Testament times, but had even specifically given a promise where he said, you will not be burned by the flames. That's why these men could have this confidence. Let's keep going. Our time is fleeting. 19-25. Then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and his attitude toward them changed. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times hotter than usual and commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. So these men, wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes, were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. The king's command was so urgent, and the furnace so hot, that the flames of fire killed the soldiers who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leaped to his feet in amazement and asked his advisors, "Weren't there three men that we tied up and threw into the fire?" They replied, "Certainly, O king." He said, "Look, I see four men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed. And the fourth looks like a son of the gods." Questions. Daniel clearly includes many details in his account to heighten the drama of what happened. List the details in verses 19 through 23 and show how they enhance the account. What details did you come across? Just say them out. Seven times hotter. That fire was stoked. The strongest soldiers of the army bound these men.
Neb was furious.
Nebuchadnezzar was furious.
Wow.
All the clothes is listed, the turban and the pants. You can tell they're dressed as Easterners, not as Jewish people who would just have worn robes. But they've got pants and robes and turbans on, all this flammable clothing. What else?
The flames killed the soldiers.
Flames killed the soldiers. What was yours, Mark? Yes, get them in there. And at the end of the paragraph, I kind of like how it's worded. And the men fell into the furnace. Dot, 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 dot. Yes, Joyce. Yeah, I'm not sure. The best explanation I heard in the commentaries was they would sometimes do these, make huge kilns that were kind of like a tunnel with one end closed off and one end open. That was the closest I got. We got some important questions, though, to go yet. Using Bible helps find out who the fourth man in the furnace might have been. What did you find?
Jesus.
Jesus is often an explanation that's given. And the reason is because the King James Version, in the King James Version, Nebuchadnezzar says, "And he looks like the Son of God." What does the NIV say? Like a son of the gods. I've studied this account many times, and my questions have always started to gravitate more toward the correct translation as a son of the gods. This time, in having studied it thoroughly in the Aramaic, I am convinced that it is a son of the gods. That was a false translation in the King James Version that Luther and other translators did not follow. And it's a mistake because what they did is, usually in the Hebrew Old Testament, the word God is in the plural. When it refers to the true God, kind of a hint of his triune nature, it really says gods for God. The verb that will follow it is always singular, however. In this chapter, whenever gods is used, it's only referring to the pagan gods. Anywhere where the true God is referred to in this chapter, it is always a singular God. And so I'm convinced now completely that it is a son of the gods. And Nebuchadnezzar is speaking with his Babylonian religious point of view. However, there was another hint in the text that would explain for us believers who this might have been. I don't think it was the pre-incarnate Jesus there. Did anybody see another clue? Ellie? Yes. Nebuchadnezzar says specifically in verse 28, God sent an angel. So this time through in my study of Daniel, I'm more convinced than ever that it was one of God's protecting angels that was there with them, that protected them from the fire. Okay, let's finish off our questions because the bell's going to ring any moment. I won't. Oh, it did already?
Yeah.
List the amazing details about this miracle that are pointed out in verse 27. Unscathed, no smell of smoke even, unsinged, right? And analyze Nebuchadnezzar's closing comment in verses 28 and 29. Did Nebuchadnezzar come to the true faith?
No.
Why do you think not?
Verse 29 says, "For no other god can save in this way." No other god.
No other god, small g, can save in this way. I think that in this way, too, is something.
Yeah.
Well, other gods can save, but they can't save in this way.
Right.
Dan, what was yours?
Well, two things. First, you said about analyzing the Hebrew comments. You can't frighten faith in something. So just witnessing this event is not going to instill faith.
And also, what about
fear. You can't. Fear doesn't instill faith. What does Nebuchadnezzar say in that final comment?
Well, if anybody says anything bad about yeah. God, yeah. I'll have them.
Yes. Yeah, again, his wording, right? If anybody, notice how carefully he chooses the wording. If anybody says anything against this God. Well, he's clearly not saying anybody who says that he, that the Lord is not the only true God, may his help. No. He's just saying, if you say anything against this God, then I will turn your houses into rubble and tear you into pieces, like he had said way back in the beginning. So I think it's pretty clear he didn't come to faith in the true God, right? Yeah.
He didn't tear down the image, and he didn't proclaim that the people should stop worshiping.
Didn't tear down the image, and he didn't proclaim that the people should stop worshiping it either. Okay, if you could take your chair and set them around the table, please pick them up, however, don't drag them across the floor. That will help for our potluck. Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
I got my haircut.
That's good.
And then,